As we continue through this series, and we are just certainly just beginning, if you're a guest here, we begun a few weeks ago on a series called The Life and Times of Jesus Christ, and we are literally following Christ from his birth all the way through into Revelation and his second coming, and it's going to be a long journey, but I feel that it is what the Lord would have us do at this time. It is a foundational element that must exist in every church, and we certainly want it to exist here. And as we move through this, we find ourselves today in this story. It's good to be able to take on this story sometime other than the week preceding and the week following Christmas. Because that's where most of us have got our theology when it comes to the issue of the birth of Christ. And it's a sad acknowledgement, but the fact is we so often get our theology from the culture around us rather than from scriptural facts and from historical truths. And certainly when it comes, yes, am I not on? How's that?
Good. And when it comes to the wise men, when it comes to the issue of we three kings, when it comes to the fame that has followed after them, our understanding, I'm afraid, is generally based on Christmas cards rather than theologians. I mean, the legends run deep. If you've looked into this matter, you know that they do. I mean, we have tales of Asian kings and the traditions of three in number. There's the lore of the fact that they represented the three families of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and you'll have to look way back in Genesis to even read about them. That's why one of them is pictured always as a black man from Ethiopia. Now, all that may be true, but we don't know that. It's even believed by many that the three skulls of the three wise men were found, and I quote, in the 12th century by one Bishop Reynold of Cologne, and they are currently on display in the Cologne Cathedral in Cologne, Germany. Interesting. But the fact is, we really know very little beyond there came wise men from the east. And we don't know their names. We don't know the details of their lives. We don't know the positions that they held in their day. But the pictures that we see show them kneeling with the shepherds at the manger scene, despite the reality that the wise men would have arrived months, even up to 2 years after the birth of Jesus Christ. But you know, it makes for a good story, and it's so hard to get everybody together for those photo ops, right? So the stories go, and we accept them. Even the gifts that these kings brought this new young Jewish king, they seem also strange to us today. I mean, we would have wanted like a flat screen or, you know, a new iPod or new iPhone or something, but yet they brought some stuff that just seems kind of strange to us. But again, they're just accepted blindly as part of the manger narrative. I mean, we're not really sure if there's some real meaning behind the choice of gifts that they brought. Or maybe they just held great value in their day. And this was the iPhone of their day. Christian tradition says that they brought Jesus gold because gold is associated with kings and Jesus is the King of Kings. It's said that they brought frankincense because frankincense was often used in church worship and it expressed a heart of worship towards Jesus. And lastly, that they brought myrrh because myrrh is a perfume that in that day they would put on dead bodies to make them smell nice, and it showed that Jesus would suffer and he would die. Now we don't know whether any of that's true. Makes for a nice story though, doesn't it? One thing is for sure, that lost in all of these stories and all the traditions and the endless renditions of Away in the Manger is one stark fact that we know of, that these wise men traveled far to see Jesus. They were wise men. And they apparently set aside their lives. They set aside the normal pursuits of people at that time to follow after a king. A king which they no doubt knew very little about. It's the way we all came to Jesus. But they seemed to know enough about Jesus that this king would impact the world and impact all time, as well as them ultimately individually. These men who came, they were by all accounts the intelligentsia of the day. They were the smart guys. And the smart guys that set aside their lives to follow after Jesus. So we really only know a couple of things about these guys. One, they were smart. And two, they came to find Jesus. We live in an age today that sadly, Christianity is increasingly becoming presented in the media, in the culture at large, as the stuff of the weak and the stuff of the ignorant. You don't have to read very long before you quickly pick that up. There's a strong insinuation that Jesus is all and well and good for, say, the recovering addict or the socially inept. But it was never to be for the educated, the cultured, the thinking individual. Such, therefore, says that once you're educated and once you're learned, that the whole God thing clearly becomes a fantasy and it becomes a farce and it's abandoned for the clarity, if you will, the accuracy, or at least perceived, of science in the pursuits of modern man. Yet it clearly appears today that science alone is running into problems, is running into questions it cannot answer, and phenomena that cannot be explained purely with the use of chemicals and data. Gregory J. Brewer, he's a PhD, he's a professor of neurology and medical microbiology at the University of California, Irvine. He says the following, quote, according to Darwinism, all life on Earth arose by natural variation and selection of the most fit. But many questions raised by Darwin's contemporaries remain unanswered today. These problems are compounded by the unique DNA sequence information now in from the Human Genome Project and our understanding of the irreducibly complex function of biological systems. Intellectual honesty will soon force many scientists to abandon Darwin's theory of the evolution of species in exchange for intelligent design or outright biblical creation. Smart guys. It's interesting that that statement comes now today and on the heels of what is, frankly, overt onslaught on the campuses of American universities against Christianity, even against Christians as a people. And it's bigotry and anti-religious rhetoric and religious, blatant religious discrimination. There is today an open and accepted attack within the walls of our public educational institution. And such, frankly, should bring outrage within the Christian society, not to mention even the secular society that hypocritically cries peace and tolerance. This constant and often overwhelming nature of the assault of which I am speaking against this particular group of people, frankly, has proven to be a little too much for a generation of dispassionate, undisciplined, and theologically uneducated college students. Forgive me if you're a college student. But as a college student, you are at this point in your life at the same time trying very hard to endure possibly the greatest need of your lifetime to be accepted and even embraced by what is the cultural majority of our day. I wonder, as the average college student is moving out there today, whether he or she will be able to survive it. Some years ago, here in this church, we were trying to book author and creationist Ken Hovind. Many of you know who he is. He was at that time offering himself to venues such as universities to debate creationism versus evolution. We thought that'd be cool. So we tried to bring him here to our local educational institution, but sadly we could find no one willing to debate him. Oh, we found plenty of people who were willing to comment on him, just not anyone who would do so to his face. And so we reached far and we reached wide in our attempts to find someone within a science or biology department who was willing to step up to the plate and do more than just lob rotten tomatoes from hidden foxholes where there is safety in numbers. What we did get from professors and, quote, professional, end quote, science teachers at several regional institutions was responses too foul to repeat from this pulpit. And angry, incredibly scathingly angry, spitting fire angry replies intimating that we had offended them and kicked them in their private parts. I mean, you would have thought I said nasty things about their mother. One professor from the University of Minnesota fired off an angry email telling me, by the way, all we did is make an invitation. No insinuation. An angry email to me telling me to get my effing head out of the sand. From a university professor. Because I believe that God created the earth and not random chance. Ironically, I find it interesting that even the very laws of science for which they stand on, like an island in the midst of an ocean of doubt, disproves their very premise. Evolutionism claims that over billions of years, everything is basically developing upward, becoming more orderly and complex, correct? However, science's second law of thermodynamics says the opposite. It says that the pressure is downward and that everything goes into simplification and into disorder. Meaning things degrade naturally. They do not naturally become better and more complex. So these folks even throw out the very rules of science when they do not fit their preconceptions. Dr. Brewer went on to say this: theories are to be modified or abandoned when they are inconsistent with one significant fact. Based on relationships of similar genes, large numbers of unrelated genes, and irreducible complexity, Darwin's evolution of species needs to be replaced by intelligent design. According to the Bible, the designer was God, with more than adequate intelligence and power to create all the major kinds of life in a short period of time. While we'll never be able to prove the singularity of creation by God, the evidence better supports faith in God rather than faith in Darwinism. Now, if you are out there and you're reading it all, you know that recently we have seen a rise in this thing we call intelligent design. Now, intelligent design isn't saying that Jehovah God is creator. It just simply says somebody did this. And to me, there's a lot more respect going in that direction. I would have more respect in you if you believed that aliens brought us here and dropped us off than to believe we came from muck. See, the premise to intelligent design is that the world and its parts are simply too complex to have randomly come together in such fabulous and minute and symbiotic forms and relationships. And the more you study it, the more you stand back and go, wow. Ironically, one of the greatest catalysts for this thinking within the science realm is the advancement of DNA. So the further they dig, the more their theory falls apart. Bill Gates once said, DNA is like a computer program, but far, far more advanced than any software ever created. Amen, Bill. You see, the human genome has just simply pushed evolutionary thinking out and beyond all odds, all explanation, and beyond, frankly, all real scientific thinkers. Paul Charles William Davies, he's an English physicist. He's a writer, he's a broadcaster, professor at Arizona State University, as well as the director of Beyond, the Center for Fundamental Concepts in Science. Another smart guy. He says this: scientists are slowly waking up to an inconvenient truth. The universe looks suspiciously like a fix. The issue concerns the very laws of nature themselves. For 40 years, physicists and cosmologists have been quietly collecting examples of all too convenient coincidences and special features in the underlying laws of the universe that seem to be necessary in order for life and hence conscious beings to exist. Change any one of them, and the consequences would be lethal. Fred Hoyle, the distinguished cosmologist, once said, "It is as if a super intellect has monkeyed with physics." Mm-hmm. To see the problem, he said, imagine playing God with the cosmos. Before you is a designer machine that lets you tinker with the basics of physics. Twiddle this knob and you make all electrons a little bit lighter, and twiddle that one and you make gravity a bit stronger, and so on. And it happens that you need to set 30-something knobs to fully describe the world around us. The crucial point is that some of those metaphorical knobs must be tuned very precisely, or the universe would be sterile. Example, neutrons are just a tad heavier than protons. And if it were the other way around, atoms couldn't exist because all the protons in the universe would have decayed into neutrons shortly after the Big Bang. No protons, then no atomic nucleuses, and no atoms. No atoms, no chemistry, no life. Like Baby Bear's porridge in the story of Goldilocks, the universe seems to be just right for life. There's a great astronomer by the name of James Jeans, and he once claimed the universe begins to look more like a great thought than a great machine. And yet today we are here this morning, despite all the contrary scientific evidence, the lack of empirical evidence to support their theories, man remains defiant. What about psychology this morning? What about medicine? I mean, they claim to have all the answers this morning, too. They say they have the answers to social ills and life's empty despairs. Yet would anyone this morning here actually step back from all this and claim that we are succeeding on this account? Or would you, as I do, clearly observe that the world is crazier and more unhappy than ever? And yet we have more stuff than ever. Edward Shorter of the University of Toronto, who studies the history of psychiatry and medicine, wrote in the Wall Street Journal, he said this: modern U.S. psychiatry has adopted a philosophy that psychological diseases arise from chemical imbalances and therefore have a very specific cluster of symptoms, he says. But in spite of evidence to the contrary, that the difference between many so-called disorders is minimal or non-existent. These, quote, disorders, end quote, are then treated with expensive drugs that are no more effective than placebos. He goes on and finishes his article by saying psychiatry seems to have lost its way in a forest of poorly verified diagnosis and ineffectual medications. Now, you can be offended by what I'm saying here today, but I want you to understand, I'm not saying it. These are the smart guys. The fact is, this morning, statistics tell us that 1 in 4 will have a significant episode of mental illness at some time in their life. 1 in 4. In fact, those statistics go on to tell us that 1 in 10 Americans suffer from some form of depression today. 121 million people around the world currently suffer from some sort of depression, and people diagnosed with depression increases 20% every year. So the bottom line is that only 1 in 3 Americans say that they're very happy, according to a recent Harris poll. What about crime? How are we doing on that? I mean, violent crime, interestingly enough, has actually decreased in the last decade. So you're like, yes. Except you also need to realize that to attain that, the USA has the highest per capita prison population in the Western world. So it doesn't appear that we actually resolved the problem. We just simply locked it away. Now, I want you to be very careful that you do not misunderstand me today. I am not in any way, especially if you're guests here, it's like these people are anti-government, anti-science. My wife's in the medical world, so that's just not true. I mean, no one this morning is saying that science and medicine and government and law enforcement is some sort of utter failure or that we should throw them all out. Please, we absolutely should not. Man has indeed brought forth an increase in comfort and health and safety and a general quality of life status for all of us here. And if you are in your upper years of life, you've seen it even in your very lifetime. My point in all of this morning is to say that man has not fared well in our self-proclaimed position of God. We still lack the answers. Not to mention still lack the cure to the ills of mankind and to the problems of our society. I mean, come on, we don't know where we came from. We don't know why we came, and we don't know where we're going. From the garden until today, mankind has tried to control the field of play, and we are losing. And yet there still, ironically, is no shortage of pride and hubris. So the shepherds came to Jesus, and so did the wise men. And you know what? The wise men are still coming today. I believe that the reason this passage found its way into the historical record is just to tell us that. Wise men go to Jesus. Now, before I leave this today, the Bible also records the record of 3 other wise men. They came to my mind as I studied this subject this week. These 3 bowed before the living God, but they refused to bow before the world and false gods. And we know their names as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They, like all of us, needed only to bow to the powers that be in order to get along. Can't you just get along, Christian? Why do you have to struggle? Why do you have to strive? Just go along with it and you can have a good life. That's all they needed to do. It certainly would have gone easier for them. And let's face it, it certainly would go a lot easier for us today too. King Nebuchadnezzar was livid. Just like those university professors we contacted. He was incredulous. I mean, that these men would not bow to his control and his domain. He couldn't understand why they would risk violence and quality of life and persecution in order to make such a ludicrous stand. And that's what they're asking about you today, Christian. And the why of it all seemed to drive Nebuchadnezzar a little crazy. And you don't need to turn there, but Daniel 3:14 records his angst. It says, Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you refuse to serve my gods or to worship the gold statue I've set up?" And he goes on saying, "I'll give you one more chance to bow down and worship the statue which I have made when you hear the sound of the musical instruments. But if you refuse, you'll be thrown immediately into the blazing furnace. And then what God will be able to rescue you from my power? What God? What God, Neb? My God. The real one. And in verse 16 and 18 in that passage, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied, "Oh, Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you. I wonder, Christian, is that your attitude this morning? We don't need to defend ourselves before you. If we're thrown into the blazing furnace, they said, the God whom we serve is able to save us. He will rescue us from your power, your majesty. But even if he doesn't, we want to make it clear to you, your majesty, that we will never serve your gods. We will never worship the gold statue you have set it up. We want to make it clear to you that you can pass all the laws you want. You can change the culture around us all you want, but we will never bow to your gods. We will never bow." Verse 19 says, Nebuchadnezzar was so furious. I would imagine so. Such a brash stance drives them always, always crazy. Maybe if he had had the tech, he could have also fired off an angry, profanity-laden email too. That'll get him. When those wise men kneeled that day, there were not three there, there were four. For God in flesh was there with them. When Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego was indeed thrown into the fire, Daniel records that suddenly Nebuchadnezzar jumped up in amazement and he exclaimed to all his advisors, "Didn't we tie up three men and throw them into the furnace?" "Yes, your majesty, we certainly did," they replied. "Look," Nebuchadnezzar shouted, "I see four men unbound walking around the fire unharmed. And the fourth looks like a god." Christian wise men have been coming to Jesus for a very long time. May we be so wise. To whom today will you bow, Christian? I'm not up here this morning advocating militarism or violence or anything. I'm up here encouraging Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the behavior that they took. Do what you want. We're not going to bow. And the Bible says, in the end, every knee shall bow and every tongue shall confess that he is Lord. Everyone. In closing, if I could have the music team come forward, let me read you a beautiful quote. Isaac Newton: "This most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and the dominion of an intelligent and powerful being." Isaac Newton, smart man.